weird faking a life event that has been sold to all of us as some monumental moment, the most important day of a girl's life. I don't necessarily agree that your wedding day should be the single greatest event in your life, but having it happen on screen for the first time robbed something from me. All told, I was fake married 3 times on film before my real marriage. By then, I was repeating an emotional scene I'd already played. Your entertainment comes at a cost to us performers. You should know this and acknowledge. When I started the show, I thought a lot about audience psychology. I, in all my infamy and not-girl-next-doorness, was supposed to step in after Shannon Daugherty's beloved character was unceremoniously killed off. I wasn't going to be playing Shannon's role, but it was still someone new for the fans to bond with. I had been told that many shows don't survive a major cast change. I knew that I had a slim chance at success here. People had to fall in love with my character as quickly as possible, or Charmed would die. I thought about how big the crew was and how they would all be out of a job if I failed. So I made myself look super non-threatening. I gained weight, about 10 pounds for the role. I wanted to look as soft and approachable as possible. Boring. There was an edict from the studio that none of us was allowed to cut or color her hair without permission from the studio president. I thought that was some serious bullshit. As I was about to return for my 2nd season on the show, I dyed my hair red without asking permission. Ooh. The studio got wind of it and flipped out, of course. They were furious and demanded to know how I expected them to explain this. I told them it's a show about magic. You simply say, I was mixing a potion and it exploded in my face. My hair turned red. I liked it, so I kept it. That became the very first dialogue of the season, almost verbatim, between me and the character Leo. All it takes is a little creative thought, but the studios rarely have that working for them. There was another big to-do on the set when Holly Marie Combs cut her bangs. The studio feared people wouldn't recognize her. That's how dumb they think you audiences are. If a character changes their set look in any way, audiences won't know who they're looking at. I wish you could all be flies on the wall when studio executives and producers talk about you all. Believe me, you are looked at as sheep with no minds of your own. I'd become almost a sheep myself, and I was losing my mind. Day after day, month after month, year after year, my brain space being eaten up by dense dialogue that's just slightly different from the previous episode will do that to you. 8 to 10 pages a day. I was having the same conversation that I had had in the episode a week before, but with the guest stars slightly altered. You could have interchanged anything I said in almost any episode with any other episode. That was the part that just made me insane. It was a prison for my mind. I was starting to lose my grip on my sanity, and I was so very lonely. Sometimes to amuse myself, I left the set at the end of the day with fake blood still on my face or a giant wound, and I'd stop at the grocery store on my way home. I would do it to test the public, to see how they reacted to a wounded woman. Nobody asked to help me. Not once. They would just avoid eye contact and look down at the floor. It gave me great insight into the invisibility of an abused woman. Note to society, you should always ask if a woman needs help if they look abused. Do the right thing. Be bold. Be brave. I've always liked to conduct social experiments. I think it was my way of keeping sane and entertaining my mind, which was just atrophying during this period. I could feel my mind dying, and I didn't know what to do. I was too tired, too lonely, and too sad to do anything about it. I made it a point to not involve myself in petty set politics. I think sometimes when people have led coddled lives, they like to create drama. It makes them feel like something's happening, something's going on. But I had had real drama, real problems. I refused to create non-existent problems to give my life a sense of faux importance. Only one female director was hired in the entire 5 years I was there, and the crew sank her. This was a show about 3 young women, and they had not, in all the time I was there, had a female director. But the mostly male crew, I think without even realizing what they were doing. They just cut the female director's legs out from under her. The crew would snicker in disrespect when she would direct them. I can't imagine it was a pleasant working environment. I feel horribly about not fighting for her more, but I didn't fully understand the dynamics of what was happening. My character was too busy talking to leprechauns to have the time. Any time on that show that I said I really liked a director, if it was someone from outside of the spelling, all-average, all-white male mob, which was very rare, they never returned. If I said I hated somebody, they would for sure return. There was one director we had, whom I was so excited to work with until I met him. The day he showed up to direct, we were in my fourth or maybe fifth year on the show, and the show could direct itself. It was a well-oiled machine. So in the first rehearsal of the day, after walking from point A to point B, I exited right. It's not a hugely important decision, and the new director hadn't given any direction as to whether to exit right or left. But he exploded. He yelled, "You idiot! You do not cross in front of my camera! You do not cross in front of my camera!" He kept yelling. The man had a meltdown. His voice reverberated off the walls. I was in shock. He kept yelling and now started cursing me out. "Bitch! Idiot! Bitch!" This was exactly 1 minute or so after we said good morning to each other. It was 7:30 a.m. No one shut him down. Not one person on the almost all-male crew, not one producer, not the assistant director, men I had worked with on the set for years. Why? Because the director, even if there for only 30 minutes, was a guy, and I was a young woman. I was thinking, "Excuse me, I don't even fucking know you. You're in my house, yet you feel so comfortable and assured in your place in this firmament of male directors that you're going to do this to me?" I told the producers I will never work with that man again. They assured me he wouldn't be allowed to verbally abuse me again. Guess who was back 2 months later? This is just a minor note in the screamer directors I've endured. Hollywood is known for screamers and belittlers, and their abuse gets a pass. I've never seen or heard a male actor be abused on a set. It's time for people in any workplace to do what they can when another is being bullied and terrorized. It's time to stand up for those around you. If you do not, you will be called out, you will be shamed, you will be dragged. It was just another example of a man getting a free pass. Can you imagine the first hour of your new boss's day, he screams at you in front of everyone, and not one person steps up? Maybe you can. I hope not for your sake. There is no excuse for abuse. Not ever. Being screamed at aggressively is something the body takes in, and it's jarring and traumatic. But you know, go put your short skirt back on and say the lines, little lady, because you're an actress, so you better take it. Yes, there are other industries where there is screaming, but you have to understand, there is zero federal oversight in Hollywood. It's hard to reconcile the sweet little old man I met, Aaron Spelling, with all the decades of sexist media he'd produced and put out into the world. Credit for that sexist media also goes to the people he surrounded himself with, the executives, all male, the writers, mostly male, the head writer, male, on a female-driven show, of course. What made all of the sexism on the set even more galling was the fact that the show was carried by women, made for a female audience, because they know how to get into young women's minds for sure. There is a completely understandable outcry over whitewashing, casting white actors to play roles that were in the source material meant to be for a person of color. Why is there no outcry over men telling women's stories? There should be. It's not like they do it well. They do it so it's just good enough. I'm bored of good enough. I know the public is, too. During year two of Charmed, I decided to go to hypnotherapy. I found the repetitive days so opposite to my natural rhythms that I became sick over and over. And it was at times a very stressful environment. I started to have panic attacks because of everything I was pushing down. We filmed in a place called Woodland Hills. Simply seeing the word wood was enough to make my heart race and my palms go sweaty. I was sick about 4 or 5 times a season. We would shoot 22 or 23 episodes. On hour-long TV, you were essentially shooting half a feature film in 8 days. The pace was grueling. 2 years in a row, I had 102-degree fevers and got dropped into giant trash cans in a stunt, always on the days that I was the most ill. That is the only time I allowed myself to feel sorry for myself. Part of my being a hard ass on myself for my whole life really kind of hurt me in the long run. The exhaustion was real and raw. 12 to 16 hours a day for about 5 years straight in a wash, rinse, repeat environment unlike any I'd known. Kind of like being in a really fancy factory, like working on an assembly line of sorts. One day, three of the charmed producer men strolled up to my trailer to inform me that my one friend on set, Sam, had been fired after being caught smoking weed on a school bus set. Sam was cool, not the usual Spelling crew member, with his dreads and his real smile. I was genuinely saddened because Sam was the only one I could sense was like me. But I said it was for the best. His soul needed to be free. I couldn't help smiling as I asked the producers, "So, if I smoke weed on the set, will you fire me? Could I be free?" Their response wiped the smile off my face. "We will garnish your wages for all time, no matter where you go. We will take your money, and we will ruin you, and you will never work again." All said with extremely straight faces because they were not fucking around. Fuck. This Hollywood detour of mine took me down the wrong alley. I sure did meet a dangerous crowd. Only these were rich white men on studio lots, not in the back alley. It's a particularly terrifying thing to have men tell you that you're going to be punished so badly you'll never be hired again. But that's the pervasive attitude in Hollywood. Don't step out of line, little girl. We can just point to the next one right after you. There is a constant stream of young and damaged women flowing into Hollywood. If you are reading this book because of Charmed, thank you for being a fan of the show and my character. I respect you and I honor you. I know it's brought a lot of joy to a lot of people. I was glad to be of service. I'm glad something really good was coming from what, for me, was a very difficult time. When I say anything that's negative about the show, you have to understand I'm speaking about my personal experience, not Paige Matthews, my character, but me, Rose. But you can always find good in most situations, and so that is what I choose to focus on. There is much that I'm proud of from this period. For a long time, Charmed was, and might still be, the longest-running, female-driven, hour-long show in history. I wish we got more credit for that, because it's important. In 2006, as Charmed came to an end, I returned to a changed media world. When I left society 5 years before to do the show, celebrity culture was different. The gossip websites now ruled. The paparazzi were now insanely aggressive. The tabloid magazines were drunk with profiting off Lindsay Lohan's antics and Britney Spears' troubles. And if you were well known, you were hunted. Not just by the paparazzi. The public at large became something to fear. Every stranger with a phone became a potential informant. It was the first time people started posting online where you were, what you were saying, what you were doing. Everybody was reporting on anyone well-known, and you didn't know where the enemy was because it was no longer just the paparazzi or the gossip columnist. It was everybody. I was forced to live a life where I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything, lest I be branded a bad girl. Most were so freaked out by people reporting false items, they just stayed hidden. At least that's what I did. I was overwhelmed by the media's new world order. There was no Instagram to speak for yourself, so if lies and smears were written, they were taken as fact. And wow, was I smeared. Even in a place that's supposed to feel safe, your work environment, I felt hunted and objectified. Just walking back and forth to the set on the Paramount Studios lot was stressful. There'd be a long train cart packed with tourists, all pointing at once and taking my photo. It was like, "There's the actor in her natural habitat. Please don't feed the actor." To be the one on the other side of the hunter's camera felt vulnerable as hell. I decided to escape America for a bit, thinking the hunting would be less prevalent. I got chased out of the Vatican once by about 30 German tourists. I shouldn't have been at the Vatican that day, I was so sick, but I had desperately wanted to see it. I clung on to the old stone buildings, trying to get away, and then finally, the crowd caught up to me. I was cornered. I flattened myself against the wall. I remember thinking, we're at the Vatican. Isn't seeing Michelangelo's work more important than someone on television? I was sweating and scared. I was being jostled as someone pushed through the crowd, I thought to help me. Instead, a man grabbed my hair and yanked a small clump out. I screamed and pushed, but I wasn't being let out of the circle. When they surrounded me, it was like a wild pack of dogs. I couldn't see their faces because they had their cameras pointed at me, the flashes blinding me. I could only see hands as I got pushed sideways and back, white circles where people's leering faces were. I felt as if I were being eaten alive. People need to respect boundaries. Just because you see someone you feel you know does not mean you get to harass them or touch them. The person you think you know owes you the same as any human does, which is nothing more than politeness. So be polite, be respectful, do not surround, do not grab, do not clutch, do not push. Be civilized, and you will usually get that in return. What I experienced in that crowd of fans was traumatic and assaultive. I had a small bald patch where my hair had been pulled out. These kind of situations happened frequently. Fame is something so many think they want, but the reality is something hard for them to see. The next thing many say is, you made money, as if money equals happiness, as if money equals safety, as if money equals peace. I would also say, do not make your value system mine. When I finished Charmed, I was told by my then publicist, if you need to step out the door and there's a camera anywhere, you better have someone dress you and do your makeup. God forbid you show your actual style. God forbid you go to a store like every other person and put on something that represents who you are. God forbid you wear something more than once like a normal human does. Hollywood publicists, whom you're told you must have and who cost around $6,000 a month, tell you what you should act like, look like, talk like, how you should respond to the press. They prey on fear and manipulate actors by threatening, oh, the studio will be really upset with you if you don't do this. They are a key part of the machine that keeps you in line. The kicker is, you're paying them to fuck with your head. In classic Hollywood times, publicists were the people who covered up what the stars did. Now the stars don't even really do that much. Not like they did back then, because they've been so trained not to do anything. God forbid the public find out you're human. So in any case, after Charmed, my very expensive publicist told me I needed a very expensive stylist. I should have asked, why am I paying somebody to put their idea of what I am on me? I didn't have a stylist during my pre-Charmed era, and I seemed to manage fine. What has changed? But my brain had been twisted for so long, I no longer had an internal compass. When a stylist is paid to come put a look on you, their main goal is to make you attractive to the male species. It's a very stereotypical idea of what is sexy, what is hot, what is fuckable. But it is not cool, and boy, did stylists do a number on me. I was made to look like a plastic weirdo, and I paid a lot of money to look like a plastic weirdo. The bizarre thing about the industry is, you were discovered because you were unique. What was special about you when you were discovered, they do their damnedest to remove, not unlike what traditional society does to children. When I was discovered, I had a raw quality and my own style. At the end of my career, it was Barbie hair and beauty pageant looks. Then every photo of me was photoshopped. Meanwhile, everyone online was telling me how ugly I was. Then I'd go to work and play other people. You need all your faculties to be in a semi-denial stage in order to survive it. Things that are abnormal become the norm. Up is down. And that is how I got lost from myself. I bought my first piece of important art at the height of my fame. The pieces of a woman who looks like a ghost, which represented what I felt like at the time, just lost behind this haze of objectification and misunderstanding. I'd gotten lost from myself, terribly, terribly lost. Destruction. One night in Cannes, France, wearing the most beautiful Dolce & Gabbana red lace dress, I went to a party, a huge, glamorous party where I knew no one. I ended up sitting on a couch by myself because I tend to get shy in large crowds. I noticed a man sitting on the opposite couch, also by himself. He was wearing a black suit and a black cowboy hat. We were both there for some time, two loners at a party. There are some moments that you regret for the rest of your life. This is one of them. I think I made a joke about how we were two fancy-dressed losers sitting alone at a party, and we both laughed. We started talking, and I realized he was a famous director. God damn, he was handsome. He had many hit movies under his belt, and at the time was riding a career high. He said, "Come sit next to me on the couch." I said honestly, "No, I don't want to be seen as an actress sucking up to a director." Much like how a cult works, in Hollywood, you're not meant to talk to someone whose status is higher than yours. And even though I was a star of a huge hit TV series, I had to watch out, lest I be branded a whore actress. He asked me my age, and I fibbed about it. I think I told him I was 28. I was 31 at this point. I was deep in the grips of Hollywood conditioning. The thing is, I was always playing roles that were younger, at least 5 years younger, which amplified my twisted perception of aging. You have done something wrong. You have lived. You start feeling crazier with each birthday that passes. For me, it was fear with a capital F. Fear of the future. Deep down, I was scared of where I would be in life at whatever age I wasn't yet. I was so fucked up by the cult of thought in Hollywood that I channeled my fear into trying to control the aging process. I wanted to freeze myself in time, like so many in Hollywood. And it wasn't just my head that was telling me to. It was makeup artists, hairdressers, stylists, agents, managers, you name it. They want you to stay as young looking as possible for as long as possible so they can make more money off of you. The human woman me has her own aging crap to deal with, but the actress me had a literal multi-billion dollar corporation built off her face and body. People are depending on your face to put food into their mouths and pay off their car loans. Women in general have the media world telling them not to age, but we in the public eye are being handed direct hotlines to people who could supposedly freeze us and are very encouraged to do so. And we have the money to do it. And we so often hate ourselves. Our photos are as manipulated as our minds. We get the message we are not enough times a million. We are marketed to you, the public, as something to be envied. Our looks that make you love and hate us. In the long tradition of Hollywood, one of its messages is, "Don't you wish you could look like us?" At least until we go overboard with the cosmetic fixes, then you start clucking and making fun of us. Being an actress, you are in front of a mirror for far more time than is healthy, having to consider everything about your face in relation to it being okay to be seen by the entire world is definitely not healthy. To have your teeth be 5 feet tall is not healthy. Ugh, it'll all fuck you up. I know, it did me. There are reasons actresses go overboard. For me, it was like cutting. I hated what I had become, and I wanted to destroy it. For 4 years, I barely had contact with anyone other than those on the set of Charmed. I was not in my right mind. I didn't know myself anymore. I'd lost my epicenter. I was rudderless. I was a prime target for abuse, but I didn't know that then. That night at the party in the south of France, I didn't know anything about this director, other than that he directed those movies. After a while, I went over and sat next to him. We instantly connected. There was something electric about that night. This man would become the most significant relationship in my life besides my father. And later he would outdo even my father in cruelty. But I didn't know that yet. The day before I'd met him, I'd been on the plane bound for France. I was bored and the lady next to me handed me a women's magazine. I had a flashback to the days when I had consulted those magazines to see what adult women did. In the magazine there was a quiz. What kind of man do you want? I took the test, and at the end it pronounced that I wanted somebody adventurous, funny, wildly intelligent, etc. Cool. When I met this man, I thought he was all those things. What I didn't realize is that these quizzes would serve better if they asked what you do not want in a partner. Because there are many, many things I didn't even know I did not want. Like the quiz, I had always thought more about what I wanted. Knowing what you don't want is more important than what you do want. Because the reality is, we rarely dream as big for ourselves as the universe can. By knowing what your no's are, you get to the yes, and the yes is bigger than you maybe even imagined. It would have served me well to have steered clear of the controlling, manipulative, and violent. Our relationship began very platonically. He told me he was married, but unhappily. That he came from a very traditional family where no one had ever gotten divorced. He stayed up all night long working and would sleep during the day when his wife lived her life. He said they had separate houses on a giant compound in Texas and would separate after the kids were grown. As it turns out, it's the whole rigmarole that married men always tell you, like a broken record. I just didn't know that then. I believed him, and the lost me fell for it. He magnetized me instantly. I thought he was so handsome. Another thing that attracted me to him initially was that he had this real childlike way of looking at the world. I never had that, and it fascinated me. R.R. told me I was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. He couldn't believe I was so smart and funny. He didn't know women could be funny. He couldn't believe I was an actress. He told me how special I was. It was so gratifying that someone saw me, or at least I thought he did, for assets beyond my looks, for not being the cliché of an actress, conceited, frivolous, dumb, all the things that a lot of actresses, especially aspiring ones, are accused of being, and sometimes are. You say actress and people roll their eyes in Los Angeles. I did feel ashamed that I was an actress. I wanted him to see me as a being on his level. I was so desperate to prove that I wasn't like all the people in Hollywood, because he told me how evil he thought they all were. But evil is everywhere. And just because he didn't live in Hollywood didn't mean he didn't benefit from Hollywood and its permission to men to behave horribly. This man in the cowboy hat sold his lifestyle superior to mine. He said he'd lived a pure life where he'd never done drugs and never partied or lived wildly, which is why he found himself in such a successful situation at his age. I believed him. In my head, his career was much more important than mine. Certainly the world valued him a lot more. My career was just something I did, something I was, frankly, embarrassed about. I've recently realized that I was the powerful one all along. But most of these powerful men, well, it's unlikely they're going to help you see that. Theirs is the career, yours is the hobby. For 3 weeks after Cannes, R.R. and I had no communication. Then one day I texted him, and he texted me at the exact same moment. This was something we did continually from that moment on. It felt like a sign that we were incredibly, deeply connected. He would send me a t-shirt of his with his scent on it, packed in a Ziploc bag, and I'd send him one of mine back to him. We fell fast and we fell hard. It was exhilarating, and so much more interesting than just pretending. This was supposedly real life now. Please take heed. When someone tries to insert himself into your life very quickly and rushes to tell you he loves you, that should be a big warning sign. And as much as you want to hear it, as much as you're hungry to be seen with a capital S, as much as you've been lonely and just waiting for this, understand that very often these are the men who will turn on you. by the time RR revealed his true identity, I was so deeply in love that I couldn't adjust to what was going on. He was so amazing to me at the beginning, such a gentleman, that I figured it must have been my fault, that I must have done something wrong for him to turn cruel, to stop respecting me. No, it was his plan all along, conscious or subconscious. I found that when someone tells you they love you too fast and overwhelms you and wants to move in right away, it's a trap. No, a man like that most likely wants to own you and control you in order to make himself feel powerful and significant. Know that things will change. Try to look out for the warning signs and the red flags because there are many, and women tend to really discount them. I didn't see what was plainly clear. See, it's not just society that gaslights you. It's ourselves. We need to protect girls from these kinds of situations by telling them from birth that they are worth just as much as boys. I wish I had known that. That our careers and endeavors matter just as much. That we have just as much potential and power residing in our bones, if not 10 times as much. If we raised our girls correctly and didn't fill their heads full of fairy tale weddings and Prince Charmings, full of beauty magazine bullshit advice about what a man wants and how to please a man and how to keep a man, a lot of girls wouldn't fall for these dangerous men, wouldn't fall into these dangerous situations. We could save a lot of lives. As for me, I had never been wildly in love before, not like this, not out of control. I still had one final season to go on Charmed and was annoyed that work got in the way of us being together. We were totally engrossed with each other. I looked at him as my lover, my friend, my life. We were obsessed with each other. We got together in my Spanish house, where we hid out from the paparazzi, the fans, the world. I couldn't go anywhere without being followed, recorded, spied on at this point. I had lived in my own bubble even before he showed up, so it was easy to keep what happened between us in my house secret. He was very concerned about his public image, and he loved being known as the guy who stayed together with his wife. One of my biggest regrets in life is not comprehending the damage we were causing, not comprehending collateral damage, not comprehending my damage. His wife and kids were in the faraway state of Texas and easy for me to ignore, just like he did. I didn't mention their relationship. He didn't either. In my head, it didn't exist. I didn't want to know. I took my cues from him. He would tell me things like he had moved out and then gone back to her. He had gotten married at 19, too young to know better. He made it sound like the only thing keeping him with her was the fact that no one in his Catholic family had ever had a divorce. And I thought to myself, you just need to be a braver man. Why would you live your life in a way that wasn't true to yourself? This was very selfish of me. But also, I think he was living true to himself by cheating on her. But the me wasn't really there at this point. I was so scared all the time. Scared he'd leave, scared the man I had waited for would go. I had no idea what I needed at this point. Yuck. I was needy, a broken person, and I felt whole with his love shining on me. I am embarrassed by all of this now. There's an old song that goes looking for love in all the wrong places. Yeah, that about sums it up. I found out too late that to have a secret relationship really suits a manipulator. He encouraged me to cut off all contact with my friends, not that I had many locally in Los Angeles, and with my family. Nobody could know about us. I simply disappeared from the outside world, even more than I already had because of Charmed absorbing my life. This relationship had all the hallmarks of my mother's relationships, and I thought I was so different. Nope, even worse than not different, I was now a cliché. I wish I could go back in time and get myself the hell out of there and not be involved in hurting others. Nope. I was in for 5.5 years of gaslighting. Some months into our relationship, he told me he was writing the lead female part for me in his next movie, which was going to be a double feature with Quentin Tarantino. They had both grown up in the 1970s seeing these pulp movies called grindhouse movies, which played in theaters as a double feature. They were played together with these fake trailers in the middle as an art piece. They were best friends and pigs in shit. RR's film was going to be called Planet Terror, which in retrospect is the perfect title for a lot of my life with him, and Tarantino's was to be Death Proof. They were salacious, but as female exploitation flicks go, they're pretty great art. They're punk and fucked up. But yeah, objectification was on high, and so was intense abuse of women, both in reality and symbolically. RR started coming to visit the set of Charmed at Paramount Studios, and we would meet up in my trailer. People saw, but because he was a writer-director who had started writing apart from me, it was okay to be semi-seen in public. I profoundly regret and publicly apologize for my part in this. I carry a deep, deep regret for the pain and heartache I caused. Also, not insignificantly, I could have saved 4 years of my life and my own heartache and pain. But at the time, I was warped in the head. As I had with so many people, I told RR about my assault at Sundance early on in our relationship, the first or second night we saw each other. I still was consistently having nightmares where I'd sweat through the sheets and wake up yelling, and I was still shaking because I saw my monster at an Amphar charity event. I was seated next to the monster at the event. I met RR later that evening. I was in shock. RR, of course, said the traditional macho thing, "I'm going to beat him up." Of course he never did, never would. You see, RR was a faux tough guy, as most bullies are. But I didn't know that quite yet. I believed him, and really looked forward to the day when my perpetrator would get punched. I was really excited about working on the film together, Planet Terror, for a couple reasons. One, because it sounded like a dope film, and two, I wanted to get back into film through the back door in a way that the pig monster couldn't sabotage. I thought if I came out in a Rodriguez or Tarantino film, I'd be protected. I couldn't be hurt by the blacklisting anymore. I could finally work at a level that matched my interests and tastes. I'd been starved mentally for years, robbed of varied roles and experiences by a bitter, relentless swine. Speaking of swine, turns out Tarantino knew about my settlement with the pig monster before I even got cast in Death Proof, a movie he made me audition for 3 times. The first time I met Tarantino, and for years after, every time he'd see me, he said, "Rose, I have your movie Jawbreaker on Laserdisc. I can't tell you how many times I use the shot where you're painting your toes. Your feet are in tight focus, and your face is blurry. I've used it so many times." Let me break down what Tarantino is really saying. "I have your movie Jawbreaker on Laserdisc." He went out of his way to buy a collectible, at least $10 more for the Laserdisc. "I can't tell you how many times I use the shot where you're painting your toes." Tarantino has a known foot fetish. To him, seeing a naked foot is the equivalent of a breast person getting turned on by nipples. That means Tarantino paid extra money to jerk off to my young feet and told me about it loudly over and over for years in front of numerous people, as if I should be so thrilled that he donated his solid motherfucking gold semen that is clearly better than all the other semen in the world, and he gave it up for little old me. It's time men realize their semen isn't all that. RR said he was going to be my savior in the film industry, and I believed him. He was my knight in shining cowboy hat. He drilled it into my head over and over how lucky I was to be with him. I'm mortified that I had such deep programming, the man a savior thing, that I bought it. But who was buying it? Me, a lost and programmed Hollywood cult member. RR was wildly jealous, which at first, like most, I took as being flattering. I took off a turtleneck sweater one night to show him my new bra, and he asked me, "What kind of message are you sending with that bra?" I froze. "What? What are you talking about? I'm wearing a bra under a turtleneck." You're sending a message to men in that bra.
What? No, I'm not.
A huge fight and tears ensued as I tried to prove I wasn't trying to lure men to bed with my bra. If he saw an old photo of me with any ex-boyfriend or heard any reference to one of them, it would set him off into a rage where he'd do something utterly brilliant, like throw his laptop out the window. Obviously because of press, he knew whom I'd gone out with in the past, and it drove him crazy. When he got angry, his eyes turned black, even under his eyes, like my father's did. He's a big guy with big, broad shoulders, and when he was mad, he was beyond intimidating. It was terrifying. When he'd rage, it felt like my hair was blowing back from my head with the force of his anger. My hair blew back a lot. I took to hiding more of myself to avoid explosions. It became a steady cycle of being accused of imaginary sins and me putting out fires constantly so he wouldn't blow up at me. That's how it is. You start hiding some of your past, doing all sorts of things to prove that you're not what you're being accused of. You're in reaction mode at this point. The gaslighter does this to keep you destabilized, because if you're always reacting to a flare-up or an explosion, or getting berated and you just want to avoid it, you start monitoring your words, monitoring everything, hoping pictures of you alongside a guy from your past don't surface because there will be hell to pay. He could be very, very vicious and very damaging. Something he said to me over and over was, "I got you at your ripest. I got you at your ripest." Meaning he got me at the perfect age for beauty. That is so disgusting and so damaging to a girl's brain. It filled me with anxiety and panic about aging, knowing that I was not going to be ripe for long, that I must do everything I could to stay this perfect being. Because if I wasn't perfect, then what was I? It quickly became normal, being stressed all the time, because I was still so in love. And intermittently, RR would make up with me, of course, and would be amazing for a day. I would see this purity of soul, this luminous and magical thing inside, so I wanted to catch it like a firefly. But then that firefly turned into Godzilla and breathed fire on me. When RR later asked me to marry him, which was so monumentally absurd, I didn't know what to do. All that was going through my head was, "Don't ask me in Texas. I fucking hate Texas. I don't want to have this memory here." But he did ask, and I said yes, mostly because I didn't know how to say no. My main reaction was thinking I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I didn't know how to say no because I never saw that reflected anywhere in popular culture. You virtually never see a woman saying no to a marriage proposal. All you see are girls freaking out, so overjoyed that someone finally wants to marry her. A man chose her. Oh, yay. I think politeness is a particular curse for girls and women. That's what Dom, the short film I directed, was about. My direction to the male lead in Dawn was simply, basically, she's a mouse, and you're the king cobra, and you're hypnotizing her, so she doesn't ever even see what's coming, and you're going to do it by scrambling her brain. It's been done to me by men, and it was done to me by Hollywood. It's what we do to girls. We send them out into this world with politeness as the strap that keeps our hands tied behind our backs. Then we meet wolves. It kills us. I read about a girl. Her male neighbor kept offering to help her carry her packages, and when she repeatedly refused, he accused her of being the kind of girl who refused help. She finally relented, and of course she wound up being attacked. That's what politeness does. In any case, I said yes to RR, even though I didn't see us married. I did still love him at that point. The media went crazy over the engagement, of course. Perez Hilton, that oily gossip columnist, started writing whore across my face every day, but not RR's. We were living in his castle. Seriously, he'd bought a place that the previous owner had turned into a castle, a former water tower, embellished with turrets and everything. RR had commissioned a gigantic painting of me on the ceiling above the stairs. I was nude. It's pretty weird to have a 6-foot naked version of yourself above your head. I was caught up there, at my ripest. He played increasingly cruel power games. I had told RR I'd always seen myself having a little girl and naming her Cherry Darling. I never exactly saw myself having a kid with him or with anybody specific, but this daughter was real enough in my mind that I had written letters to her, stuff that she could read from me when she was older. And RR said, "I'm going to name the character I'm writing for you Cherry Darling. That way you can't have a child with another man and call her that. This is our baby. It'll last for all time. This is the child we're making." That really should have been a breaking point. His taking that name for the character was a serious form of theft. Because he was right. After that, I would never be able to name my child Cherry Darling. As confused as I was, the role of Cherry Darling was shaping up to be amazing. One day early on, he called me and said, "Machine gun leg. That's it. She's got a machine gun leg." And I was like, cool, right on. I did love his imagination. The role was written for me, with a lot of the things I actually said and did, and a lot of passages that are direct quotes from me. I think it's probably his most realized female character, one not just there as a sexy caricature. Even so, on the page, Cherry was more sex fantasy than human being. I mean, she was a go-go dancer. But I fought for Cherry. Cherry, in fact, saves the world. Tarantino's half of Grindhouse was death proof about kick-ass cars and women dying horribly. What's done to the women in Death Proof is disturbing. Hollywood is very comfortable sanctioning the abuse of women and calling it art. I don't think most people understand that when audiences eat this shit up, it's programming them by desensitizing them. They learn to only really see women in an objectified sense. The poison carries through the audience. The audience then goes home and mirrors that behavior. And I'm telling you, what goes on behind the scenes bleeds through to you. I feel that when you see how women are treated on screen, you see what the director really thinks about them. You see how little he values them. Tarantino's always lauded for having strong women characters. But I would say look at what they go through. He beats the shit out of them for enjoyment. Yes, you had Zoe Bell and Tracy Toms and Rosario Dawson kicking some ass. But look at what's done to the other women. Sidney Poitier's daughter, named Sidney Poitier, played a character named Jungle Julia. Tarantino was always on her for not being street enough. It was so embarrassing. She dies by having a car split her vagina in half, her torn leg flying out the window. Another woman has her face skidded off by a tire. While shooting the death scene of my character, Pam, I got tortured in the car and had to shatter my face against the plexiglass. What the female characters in Tarantino's films get in terms of strength, they pay for in brutality. And once again, it's okay. It's just women. I wanted Death Proof's Pam to look very different from Cherry in Planet Terror. I wanted Pam to look like this angelic creature because I knew she was going to get the shit kicked out of her and die in a violent and horrible way. I thought psychologically, if I can make her look angelic, I can make the audience feel something for her before she dies. The filming began, and the nightmare began. I was shooting Charmed during the day in L.A. for half the week. Then I'd fly to Texas to film Planet Terror at night for the other half. It was toward the end of the entire Charmed series, almost 5 straight years of working those 12 to 16-hour days I mentioned earlier. I was ground down and exhausted. But RR was constantly talking about how he hated actors who complained on sets. So I never complained. I should have. It was a brutal schedule. I would be on the airplane going back Monday morning at 6 after shooting all Sunday night, every time barely making my flight. When I arrived in Los Angeles, I had to rush straight to the Paramount Studios and be a whole other person, this wildly different character, Paige. My brain was starting to scramble on top of its already fragile state. Cherry was scantily clad through the movie, so I wore a lot of spray tan. It felt like at least something was covering me up. We used an aerosol leg spray. I learned about it from some of my friends who perform drag. It stays on no matter what. I'm probably going to get some crazy-ass disease because in the small enclosed space of my trailer, the makeup artist and I sprayed my entire naked body every single day. We went through a can a day, and these are tall cans. We shot in severely humid Texas, so it would never dry. I left orange smear marks everywhere I went. I would get on the plane to L.A. with my fake tan and a packet of baby wipes and scrub at my skin. I had to turn pale again to look like Paige. It looked like I was molting. We shot Planet Terror at night, all night long. R.R. worked with more or less the same crew over and over, so they knew him very well. They stared at me since I was the outsider, and everyone knew we were together. And his wife, from whom he was now officially separated, was the producer. That just seemed cruel and unusual for everyone involved. I think that was a form of psychological torture for both of us. R.R.'s campaign of terror started the first night of filming. The character that Freddie Rodriguez, no relation, played was named El Rey, the King in Spanish, which is now also the name of R.R.'s television network, El Rey. The character El Rey was a stand-in for R.R. himself. There was a scene where El Rey and Cherry, Freddie and I, kiss. For a week before we shot it, R.R. mysteriously started growing out his facial hair. He didn't tell me or anyone else what it was about. When it came time to shoot the scene, R.R. banished everyone from the set except for himself and me. You don't usually do that when it's just a kiss.